This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Our next keynote speaker is David Garneau, Associate Professor from the Fine Art Department of the University of Regina in Saskatchewan in Canada. This is David's second visit in recent times. He was here for the Forum Return of the Native contestation, collaboration, co-authorship, and I know there were people in this audience who were involved and present for that fine forum a few years ago. And I think he's also bound for Auckland, if I'm not mistaken, in May for the joint Museums Australia and Museums Aotearoa conference, where no doubt elements of what we've been discussing over these few days will again percolate and continue to be discussed. David will speak on some of the complexities and ironies around the concept of decolonising the museum. Please join me in welcoming David Garneau.
Thank you, Jim. That was really stirring. I'm going to say almost the same things from a different point of view. I think about 4 years younger and still angrier. And in maybe 4 or 5 years, I'll be as temperate. I really hope so. That was so beautiful. I acknowledge the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Ngunnawal and Ngambara peoples, and I am a grateful guest. I bring greetings and offer respect from the Treaty 4 territory, home of the Nehiyawak, that's the Cree, the Nahawinwiniwak, which is the Soto, Dakota, Lakota, and Nakota peoples, and the Métis, my nation. Thank you, Margot Neal, the National Museum of Australia, the Australian National University, and all the organizers and funders for returning me to this beautiful country to speak in this remarkable building near this exceptional exhibition and among your mindful selves. I'm humbled by the company. Replying to a colleague who is defending a friend, Winston Churchill famously quipped, "He is a humble man, but then he has much to be humble about." I resemble that remark. I'm neither a museum curator, nor an anthropologist, nor a PhD of any strain. I'm a painter. I curate art, mostly Indigenous, in Treaty 4 and Treaty 6 territories. I am an artist who teaches painting and drawing at a regional university in Canada, Saskatchewan, Regina, the very trifecta of modesty. We do have summer. Ironically, in the inverted worlds of a contemporary museum and academy, where margins often center, having much to be humble about can be a quality. Legal scholar and Blackfoot philosopher Leroy Littlebear explains that Indigenous people prefer to be generalists, knowing a good deal about many things and not too much about too little. Being a specialist is a Western preference that serves capital better than it does people and planets. It reduces independence and the ability to be agile in a world of flux. Amongst this illustrious company, it is this philosophy alone that gives me hope that my multiple deficits might add up to an asset. Little Bear describes the Blackfoot worldview and pedagogy as circular, centering on stories told, retold, and understood differently in iteration. In this spirit, this paper recycles much of this conference's ideas, but differently. What you don't recognize, let's call that Métis knowledge. If you feel offended, imagine that I'm only talking about the Canadian context. So this paper is a spiral, a basket of a talk that circles our shared struggle towards non-colonial institutions, places where first peoples will feel both at home and challenged. The first section coils around the Colonial Heritage Museum and its potential for indigenization. Then it will weave in some lines about the Return of the Native Conference. Well, I'm just only going to talk about the title, really. I'll pick at a loose thread in the Encounters exhibition and twist in a shift in heritage museums from artifact necropolis to living rooms. I conclude with a knot about Indigenous humility and humiliation in the museum. This is a pared-down version of a much better talk. I've removed the humor, the charm, the poetry for the sake of time. So the basket may not look pretty, but it should hold together. This time last year, my colleague Michelle Lavallee and I curated Moving Forward, Never Forgetting, a large contemporary art exhibition, performance, art series, and community projects about the Indian residential schools and other forms of aggressive assimilation, intergenerational reconciliation among Aboriginal families, and conciliation with settler neighbors. At the opening, Tall Tan performance artist Peter Morin brought to the gallery a large collection of books whose contents have caused harm due to their erroneous depictions of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people. Over 5 hours, he and community members drummed and sang over the children's stories, novels, and history, art, and anthropology texts. They washed each page with a medicinal tea. Morin wished to honor these once retrieves, but also the author's labor. He wanted people to know about the caustic nature of these volumes, but did not want to make a spectacle of Indigenous suffering for non-Indigenous consumption. He declined to write an essay or give a speech because such actions engaged the texts according to their terms rather than his. He wanted to show, not to argue. The group cleansed the books and tried to lay their bitter contents to rest. Later, Morin planted the volumes across Turtle Island. It was a moving gesture by a humble man, a moment of grace, an instance of Indigenous critical care. And here he is, his other practices, going to museums and singing to his ancestors. Since their invention, Indians have been the subject of scholarship, museum displays, and academic conferences. The history of Aboriginals as speaking subjects in these places is recent, fugitive, and fraught, but improving. In a short time, we have gone from native informants to consultants, and now struggle towards something resembling colleagues. The next step is the non-colonial museum, to be at home in a shared keeping house rather than a guest among our objects in the house of another. To indigenize rather than merely to feature Aboriginal belongings in respectful and beautiful ways requires exquisite change, anxiety, and critical excitement for us all. The coming generation of Indigenous scholars, curators, and artists is more interested in sharing than in being accommodated. They are reluctant to replicate settler mentors and methods when they conflict with Aboriginal ways of knowing and being, and with territorial and creative sovereignties. They are more excited about learning, embodying, performing, producing, and presenting Aboriginal ways than they are about deconstructing dominant cultures' false, inadequate and humiliating misrepresentations. Wow, let's not get hasty. Creative correction is endless, necessary work and can be a lot of fun when it's not a heartbreaking grind in the irony mine. But rather than center our lives on anti-racist and anti-colonial work, expend our creative energies reacting to dominant others, First Peoples are turning to positive production, to what I call non-colonial activities, to reviving Aboriginal epistemologies, ontologies, metaphysical and material practices, and adapting to contemporary lived lives. If this work is not to be an Indigenous separatist project alone, but also to entangle and untangle colonial institutions for our mutual benefit, we need to map the moment and develop terms of engagement that produce the Indigenous without losing our Aboriginal selves. And I personally feel the weight of this invitation. How do I present an Indigenous perspective in this company without relapsing into the role of the native informant? How do I be heard without being fully apprehended? How do I participate without becoming an Indian agent complicit in assimilation? Another moment from Moving Forward, Never Forgetting. Clothed in his recently deceased father's headdress and ornately quilled and beaded regalia, Sisika artist Adrian Stimson sits in the University of Regina hallway for 5 hours each day for 3 days. Art world types will recognize a reference to Marina Abramovich's performance at the Guggenheim. Uncomfortable civilians see a play on the stoke and wooden Indian. Is he being ironic? Next to Stimson is a table with photos of his dad as a child. Behind is a large image of the old Sun Indian residential school that Senior and Junior Stimson both attended. Across from him is an empty chair. Signs and an attendant let passersby know that they can sit with the artist, but that he will not speak. Responses range from international students eager to take selfies with a real live Indian to others who sit in contemplative companionship. Some are annoyed that the artist will not explain himself. The academic branch of the colonial enterprise assumes that everything in person should be accessible to those with the means and will to access them. Stimson offers a dramatic indigenous presence, but refuses the sort of discursive engagement preferred by the non-indigenous. Frustrated would-be interlocutors, given no access to the author, to the authority, are left with their own perceptions. Others, especially natives, feel the moment. They sit in co-relational silence. They don't have to be told what to do. They cry. They share comprehending and consoling looks, nods, and shoulder pats. Some even sing, drum, or play the flute for him, for the children, for all our lost innocence. Stimson's intervention is a gentle disruption of the academic flow, an indigenous presence without apology, translation, or giving anything away but grace. I have a bad taste in my mouth for leading with a Winston Churchill quote, and I was going to cut this one out, but as I'm walking here, of course, there's that big behemoth striding across the campus. Because he also said, I do not admit for an instance that a great wrong has been done to the Red Indians of America or the black people of Australia. I do not admit that a wrong has been done to these people by the fact that a stronger race, a higher grade race, a more worldly wise race has come in and taken their place. While horrifying, it's refreshing to have the foundational sentiments of colonial thinking so plainly stated by one of its leaders. At least he admits that the place was not terra nullius, that the place was theirs. Most Canadians believe that they live in a post-colonial country, independent since 1867, and I assume that Australians feel the same way, more or less free from Indigenous rule since 1901. But First Nations, Inuit, and Métis remain in a colonial state. Most of our lands are occupied and lives governed not by Britain, but by Canada. I use the word non-colonial to indicate that because we do not live in a post-colonial country, theory arising from those states where the colonizers left can only be employed here with caution. We need new terms. Museums were never public institutions in the sense of standing outside of the state and functioning as a means of criticizing it, explains Tony Bennett. They are designed to produce meanings that serve the needs of the nation and those citizens who most benefit from it. They perpetuate dominant ideology, especially in the middle and professional classes, who engage curatorial institutions to learn what is expected of them. These publics go to museums to absorb the cultural competencies necessary to secure and reinforce their social status and distinguish themselves from the working class. That's what he says. If we transpose working class with Aboriginal people, we get some insight as to why, while these storehouses hold tons of our things, they notoriously attract few native guests. Simply put, they're not for us. To paraphrase and repurpose Bennett, heritage museums in still colonial countries are designed for settler audiences to absorb the cultural competencies necessary to distinguish themselves from Aboriginal people and thereby reinforce and perpetuate their colonial status. Contemporary heritage museums formed within colonial, capitalist, and entertainment paradigms require novelty. The Aboriginal and other forms of embodied dissent are tolerated as long as they surprise with consumable difference, but do not threaten to inspire beyond the aesthetic and the affective. Worse still, if assimilation remains the unstated desire of settler Canada and Australia, then the vogue for so-called decolonial adjustments, community consultations, Indigenous curatoria but not quite curation, may simply be the machinery of assimilation in slowed motion and with a new name. If so, then it is understandable if conscientious Aboriginals decline or limit their participation. Any native cooperation with colonial... So this is, we get it on the other side. Any native cooperation from colonial institutions, argue First Nations political thinkers Glenn Coulthard and Taiaki Alfred, is a compromise of sovereignty on the way to cultural and physical annihilation. They advocate for Aboriginal-only keeping houses, what I describe elsewhere as irreconcilable spaces of Aboriginality and sovereign Aboriginal display territories. And we just heard an example, and here's one that I have some contact with, the Siksika-speaking people in West Bank, Kelowna, British Columbia. These places exist, are growing, and are central to Indigenous separatist futures. However, I'm interested here in the possibility of collaborative futures, ones in which colonization is transformed by indigenization rather than vanquished by violent revolution. My view is that heritage museums and universities are not necessarily always and only propaganda machines. We are, of course, compromised in that whether we promote, resist, or simply benefit from colonization, we are infused by this system. However, not all such engagements are equal or total, and not all compromises are pernicious. Contemporary museums and universities do not simply reflect state ideology, but produce it. They also articulate the state's discontents and figure its remedies, one of which is Indigenous. The taste for imperialism has soured, and colonization in countries now known as Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and sometimes the United States, has shifted from the brutish invasion, broken treaty, and forced assimilation stage to the dominant culture's present wish to entreat survivors with what they call, at least in Canada, reconciliation. This activity is played out most poignantly in museums and other sites where history, nation, and identity struggle in formation. With respect to Bennett, whatever their origin, contemporary heritage museums and universities are now places where citizens, you just said the same thing, where citizens not only learn who they are and are not, but these are places they go to change their minds. And if there is a collective and explicit will to transform them from sites of colonial reproduction to spaces of non-colonial conciliation, then Indigenous curators and audiences should co-author that future. The evolution from genocidal disposition to conciliation is part of an international social justice movement codified in the United Nations Declarations of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which recognizes and attempts to ameliorate past and current injustices. But scholars, environmental, and other activists go much further. Canadian scientists like David Suzuki, philosophers such as John Ralston Saul, innumerable Native authors, educators, and leaders find in traditional Indigenous ways of knowing and being an antidote to the colonial, capitalist, patriarchal, and racist traditions that have engendered intolerable social justice and environmental calamity. This project is not about cultural mosaics or a polyphony of equal voices or rotating displays of ethnicity. It is about imagining and performing a better world based on the cultures of stewards who have thrived with care for millennia. It is no longer about Aboriginal people enduring civilizations. That was a joke. But it's about producing our own sustainable versions. We live in a moment of cultural dissonance. Colonial institutions and persons comprehend their complicity in fundamental injustice, but few can quite picture non-coloniality, a state which includes morally just, tolerably privileged, and recognizable versions of themselves, let alone imagine possible futures that do not include their replication in white skins or not. I humbly suggest that we add a 12th item to Ian Coates' list of how museums can better deal with Aboriginal people and Aboriginal publics and property, the necessity of Indigenous curators. Reparation is not simply the turning over of Native bones and belongings to Aboriginal care. It is the restoration of the community of living Aboriginal people with their ancestors and contemporary belongings in sites that should include the museums that reside on their unceded territories. While Aboriginal things are at the center of national museums, Aboriginal curatorial presence is a recent phenomenon, and the fit remains uncomfortable. To be an Indigenous curator, rather than a curator who is Indigenous, or merely a curator,
is to be in perpetual negotiation with the demands of the colonial institution and the complexity of Aboriginal worldviews, political, tribal, and family obligations. It is an unsustainable position as long as the museum remains the dominion of colonial unconscious and its elaborate means of repression. From a distance, encounters sounded like a cruel twist, a returning of the screw. Expropriated Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders' belongings returned for a visit before being returned to the other motherland. Yo-yoed from Britain, this exhibition would drop in, pause, reverse turn, and return. Behold your wonderful things, quickly, before we take them back. Axiomatic of colonization is the elimination, removal, containment, and or assimilation of First Peoples so that their territories can be occupied and resources exploited for the benefit of the colonizer. Axiomatic of the Colonial Heritage Museum, then, is that the Aboriginal peoples be separated from their better belongings, and these items be displayed as trophies of conquest, proof of possession. In this paradigm, objects are thought to be owned by the possessors, and the preservation of artifacts has priority over the needs of living native peoples in relation to them. Non-colonial museums take as axiomatic that these territories, by right of prior occupation, belong to its first peoples, whose relationship to country is not translatable as property and therefore not extinguishable by exchange, purchase, or occupation. Similarly, while some Aboriginal objects were produced for trade and given as gifts, others were not. They were plundered and ought to be returned. The non-colonial museum centers living Aboriginal people. It recognizes that non-trade, once were artifacts, now belongings, belong in the care of Aboriginal people, either in our own sovereign display territories or in co-managed keeping houses. In any case, Indigenous people should handle Indigenous belongings. In one possible future, Indigenous curators in sovereign nations will produce exhibitions of settler belongings so that all of humankind will better understand colonization. I had to put in some humor. Indigenous curators will, of course, curate the first shows. But once the non-Indigenous colleagues have learned the profession, they will be offered internships temporary appointments and eventually co-credit exhibition opportunities. And if they hang on and play their cards right, they will get their own projects. But they will only be able to curate white belongings from within an Indigenous understanding of white people. Just kidding. That would be wrong. Western-style museums, with their foundation on object preservation, favor the sterilized thing and environment over messy bodies. Such a museum is a necropolis, a city of the dead ruled by a cryogenic attitude, one that places its faith in possible futures rather than in the living present. Right? Cryogenics, that's where you freeze your body and it goes sent into the future, hoping science will be able to catch up. That's what's happening. So its residents are frozen in time and addressed to a better tomorrow. In an Indigenized heritage museum, preservation is second to use through touch, story, and haptic rather than virtual recreation. Recreation meaning also the including of making new versions of old things. The necropolitic attitude is more comfortable with the dead than the living, the embalmed and contained rather than the organic and physically engaged, the protected possession over the animated tool, and the image over the real. Virtual representations have their place, so long as that place is not to displace real people, things, and haptic making, and replace them with colonial avatars. Oh, this is just an example. This is wonderful. Maria Hupfield, I'm just not going to talk about it. Here she is in the museum. She makes them remove the cases so that she can play with the objects. And this is the gathering of Indigenous curators. There's over 100 of us in this room. And this is one of her objects. And then we do a round dance. It was just wonderful. It's the way it should be. For Aboriginal people, objects are always in relation to bodies and stories. Severing this circuit is violence. Things only house part of the story. Their makers and keepers hold the other parts. The Encounters exhibition is an extraordinary achievement, and I'm impressed by the care both of the people and their belongings. I know of no Canadian project with such broad community consultation. Particularly poignant for me were those moments when old things were paired with new, for instance, the harpoons and the fishing rod, and the stories and images that link them. This is incredible work. Twined with the pride in the text, panels, and videos, though, is melancholy. The tantalizing presence, yet enduring loss of these belongings. You can feel the curatorial tension. On one side are the Aboriginals whose ancestors made these things. On the other is the former empire that maintains possession. Grief and gentle protest echo throughout. In a text panel, Gary Murray says, "We're trying to do the right thing by our ancestors and the descendants of those ancestors today. It is the responsible thing to do, and we have the cultural duty to do it. So we basically beg the British Museum to return our cultural materials." The curators are clearly empathetic, but as agents of the Australian state, and in order to temporarily secure the objects from Britain, they had to appease their former colonizers in ways that must have been uncomfortable. But make no mistake, before it is anything else, this exhibition in Australian nation's capital, rather than touring through the First Nations, is a display of nation and the containment of First Nations. Still, the curatorial inclusion of dissent does disrupt seamless imperial display and ought to be acknowledged as such. Now I'd like to pull a thread, a creeping absence I felt when I first encountered Encounters. Greg Lehman explains on a card, "We don't want certain objects back simply because they're old or because they're worth a lot at auction. It's because these objects are important to cultural practitioners today to be able to reference their own practices, to be able to build and continue those conversations about the continuity of necklace making, of basket making, of making men's objects." And throughout this conference, people have shared moments of sensuous knowledge. A man inspects an ancient spear to check the type of resin used to affix the point to the shaft. Another follows the weave with finger to know how the basket was made. A child touches a cane, and a boy listens to his grandmother's pots. In the exhibition's many pages of text and hours of video, there are very few such close encounters. Few recorded people show an informed relationship with specific items. Many speak generally about the need for these belongings to inform contemporary culture on principle. Missing is a corporeal engagement with cultural practitioners and their ancestral belongings, performing moments where haptic knowledge is released through touch and talk. There is a great deal of aboutness, but few instances of belonging body beingness. So I got permission from John Carey to talk about his paper. In his paper, Curating the Curators, Some Reflections on the Politics and Poetics of Consultation, John Carey recalls a visit to Gundijamara, is that correct? Gundijamara community in southwestern Victoria. And so I'm going to quote a long passage, and it recapitulates what he said here on Wednesday. "And the purpose of the visit was ostensibly to discuss the objects from that country that were to be in the British Museum and that were potentially going to come on tour, that were in the British Museum and were potentially going to come on a tour to Australia as part of the Encounters exhibition. And what was so interesting about the day was how uninteresting the objects themselves turned out to be to the Gundijamara. People leafed through the booklets with polite attention, commenting here and there on a specific object, but the vast majority of our visit involved no engagement with these objects at all. They arranged to take the curators to the country on boats and by foot to see evidence of housing and aquaculture that were etched into the landscape. This was the focus of their attention, the repository of their values, and they invested significant amounts of time and energy that day, directing the gaze of curators away from the booklets and on outwards to other texts, other objects, and subjects. The lesson he derives from the experience is the feeling expressed by his colleague Jay Arthur. Jay said to me, 'I feel like I've been curated.' We are all fundamentally moved by the way in which our Gunda Jamara colleagues had reframed the whole endeavor and indeed brought into question the primacy of the objects the curators were there to discuss. So that's a beautiful moment, one familiar to anthropological narratology. The white agent's concepts are overturned by the clever native. It's not just a trope, though. It's a truth of encounters. However, I am concerned by any settler story that concludes with non-Indigenous curators believing they have the free hand to use Aboriginal objects as they like because the descendants of the original makers appear less interested in those things than they are. Conciliatory curation is a material dialogue among equals. It requires both parties to have full and equal access to the facts. This consultation, if consultation it was, did not consist of Indigenous people holding and considering their belongings, but the passing around of images in a brochure, clearly a done deal. That people might be indifferent to pictures is not the same thing as saying they're indifferent to the belongings they represent. While the images might have sufficed as things to curators who may have also seen the objects pictured, the consulted Aboriginal people did not have the same relation, preferring to concentrate on the things at hand, things that were definite rather than indefinitely theirs, rather than picture distant and immaterial to their present. You can't really connect with them without having the bare skin on them, Harley Coyne, a Noongar man, told journalist Quentin Sprague. To go across to Canberra and see it all in glass cases over there is fine, but we prefer to see things back here on country, obviously. The dark side of encounters is that displaying traded, gifted, or stolen Aboriginal objects before the eyes of the vanquished, that was the word used on our panel by our host, Geraldine Doug, and then taking them back has the effect of increasing their value. It should come as no surprise, then, that those consulted would either display coolness towards the images or speak hotly but generally about their return. Why give the colonizers the satisfaction of fulsome and intimate engagement when it'll make it look like agreement? Oops, I went too far. As Cardi beautifully explains, the site of Aboriginal culture is never going to be the museum. It's always in country, and the relationship of bodies and tangible land, story, and song. The non-colonial, indigenized museum endeavors to bring Aboriginal bodies and moments of haptic and oral communion together. At the same time, it recognizes that these are sites also for others, places to display Indigenous power to neighbors, not as signs as images alone, but as performances, as touch, as living rooms, as deeper engagements with territory and the worldviews that have emerged from these places. So why, when there are so many Aboriginal objects in our museums, so few Aboriginal people feel the right to be here? When your ancestral belongings now belong to another, being invited to visit them in their new owner's beautiful house can be humiliating. A further loss of dignity comes when you are expected to be publicly grateful for these embroidered exhibitions of power. Museums are sites of colonization when they engender in Aboriginal subjects a sense of submission and cultural humiliation rather than agency. On the other hand, to be able to contemplate and celebrate your cultural legacy in a home you truly share with others is humbling. Being overwhelmed by your people's achievements, seeing yourself in relation to and as an extension of that material and conceptual excellence, even succumbing to the pleasures of intelligence and affective display design, are among the sublime joys of humility. Such environments create relations between persons and pasts, things and peoples and each other. They engender righteous pride, dignity, and a sense of community and continuity, but also inspire a desire to exceed strategies of mere survival and defensiveness and strictly tribal aspects of identity. Humility is awe, followed by rational assessment, a grounding that allows us to leap forward. We must collaborate to design museums as sites of Indigenous humility rather than humiliation. Indigenous curation is a curation of people rather than things. From Latin, curator is linked not just to object care, but to healing, curing. Rather than cure objects in the sense of preserving them, Indigenous curators heal the estrangement between people and their belongings. They restore and restory. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.